You are listening to Primary Care Perspectives, a podcast where pediatric experts from Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and other guests discuss primary care issues that are on their minds and the hot topics that all pediatricians see affecting their daily practice. This podcast is for general informational and educational purposes only and is not to be considered as medical advice for any particular patient. Clinicians must rely on their own informed clinical judgment in making recommendations to their patients. Hi, I'm Dr. Katie Lockwood, a primary care pediatrician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and today I'm talking about stuttering. Joining me is Dr. Joseph Donaher, who's an adjunct assistant professor, a speech-language pathologist, and the research program director with the Department of Speech-Language Pathology and the Center for Childhood Communication at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Donaher.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thanks for being here. I'm going to start with a little bit of an introduction. So childhood onset fluency disorder is classified as a neurodevelopmental disorder involving a complex interaction between motor, auditory, language processing, and emotional and behavioral domains. This disorder affects 5 to 10% of preschoolers, with a typical age of stuttering onset between 30 and 48 months. This corresponds with the time period when linguistic skills are developing rapidly, we know. However, we also know that not all children will stutter, and the etiology of childhood onset fluency disorder is not completely understood, but some evidence demonstrated differences in brain anatomy and fluency control areas on neuroimaging studies. So there's a lot for us to talk about and explore here. So Dr. Donaher, my first question for you, which is one that I get the most, I would say, from my patients and their parents, is at which age would you expect a child to outgrow stuttering? Since we know that this can be normal at some ages, but when is it not?
Yeah, sure. There's some controversy on this. I mean, because when we say when it's normal at one age and not normal to others, we really are talking different types of behaviors or different types of findings. We have what we call stuttering behaviors, and then we have typical disfluencies or disruptions to the flow of speech. Often for pediatricians, the hardest is differentiating between the two. Is it really stuttering, or is it more of just typical, like a language-based disfluency profile? We know that stuttering typically begins around 2 to 4 years of age, and most children will recover or stop stuttering within that first year. But there are some other certain risk factors that can be indicative of greater concern. For example, stuttering tends to run in families. We know the inheritability factor for stuttering is about 75%. So a significant family history of stuttering indicates greater risk. If the behavior has been present for longer than 6 to 8 months, there's some more concern. If the behaviors are happening more frequently, or if others are noticing them more commonly, there's greater concern. If the child looks like they're pushing the words out or physically struggling while they're talking or straining, if the child starts to avoid talking or starts to seem to be more troubled by their speech, they're all signs of greater concern.
So that's a really helpful distinction to make, and it leads into my next question, which is when should we refer to a speech-language pathologist? I know anytime that we're concerned or a family's concerned, a referral might be appropriate, but are there any guidelines of when we really should refer to a speech-language pathologist?
Yeah, I mean, I keep this really simple. When there's concern, refer. And the reason I say that is it takes someone who really knows stuttering to kind of differentiate between whether this is something we should be a little bit more proactive with, or if we have a little bit more time, or if it's something we shouldn't be concerned with. So what I would say is when a family asks a question or is concerned, or if you hear a child struggling, I would rather refer early. If nothing else, the family will gain information about communication, how to promote more effective communication, and possibly either change some perspectives or change some things they're doing that might be not as helpful and get them into some strategies that might help the child communicate a little bit more freer.
What if the family is not concerned? Are there benefits to early referral to speech therapy that we could tell them about?
Definitely, it's easier when the referral comes earlier. And if we think about this, the longer an individual stutters, the more likely they are to encounter negative communication experiences, whether it's teasing, not being listened to, or having their message devalued. Over time, these negative experiences can cause that individual to react to their stuttering with increased tension, being frustrated or embarrassed. And what that usually leads to is speech-related anxiety, where the individual anticipates future speech breakdowns and begins to avoid or hide from those type of experiences. What typically happens from that is fairly quickly we see anxiety start to kind of escalate there. We know in this way that stuttering leads to anxiety, but anxiety doesn't lead to stuttering. And that's another question we get all the time. My child's anxious. Do you think that puts them more at risk for stuttering? And really, it's how they react to their stuttering. And being anxious might make that reaction a little bit larger, but it doesn't necessarily result in that.
That's interesting. Now, you mentioned there that there are lots of potential negative psychosocial effects of stuttering, things like negative self-perception, the anxiety, as you mentioned, and occasionally even depression. So how do you help children combat some of those psychosocial effects?
Great question, because often we're not dealing with stuttering. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with how the individual and others react to the stuttering. And that's where we really see the increase of mental health issues alongside with stuttering. So let's think about this. A school-aged child is stuttering. So they start to push their words out, or they use other tactics like switching words, talking to a rhythm, talking slower, staying quiet, changing word order in a sentence, anything they can do to hide from their stuttering. Now, these attempts at concealment become more frequent as the perceived social consequence of stuttering grows. So the more likely you think you are to be teased or bullied about your stuttering, the more likely you're going to try to hide your stuttering. Mm. And as the individual starts to anticipate these negative reactions with growing frequency, they start to avoid even more. Unfortunately, concealment of stuttering typically makes the individual feel worse. It increases social isolation, and it can make the behaviors more problematic. This can be further magnified when families are telling kids, use your tools, slow down, say it again. Mm-hmm. Or even with therapy programs that use frequency of stuttering as the outcome measure. These can all make kids feel worse about their talking and can lead to more anxiety, avoidance, and other mental health issues.
Yeah, as you mentioned, parents can play a really important role in bolstering a child's confidence. And I always remind parents of children who stutter that they should avoid filling in the words for their child and not pressure them to talk faster. They can acknowledge that their child may be frustrated and offer them emotional support. What are some other tips that you give parents to help develop speech at home?
Yeah, they're great suggestions you had there. And really, our goal should be to reduce the stress that is put on these kids, both by themselves and by other listeners, because folks are judging stuttering a certain way. And there are things that we can do. The best tool that a parent has is listening. Too often, we jump in and try to fix the stuttering.
Right.
We do better when we follow the child's lead. We want to watch out. We don't want to monopolize the conversation. And we also don't want to force the child to talk. Mm-hmm. We want to make comments and leave space. If the child has something to say or wants to say something, chances are they will there. We want to refrain from things that kind of tell them to hide more, though. We want to refrain from things like, say it again and say it slower. Think about what you want to say. All of these comments can simply reinforce the message that stuttering is bad and should be hidden.
Mm-hmm. Those are really great pearls. I'm wondering, sometimes when I have patients who have a diagnosis that they're worried about or think is going to limit them in the future, I use some famous people as examples. And I know there are some famous historical figures and celebrities who stutter. Do you ever use some of those as examples for inspiration?
Yeah, I have all of the prerequisite posters on my wall. You know, all the professional athletes who stutter, the actors who stutter, broadcasters who stutter. I will tell you, I'm an advisor to Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, the NBA basketball player, in our foundation called Change and Impact. Mm. And what's amazing about that is we bring this giant of a man in, and he meets kids who stutter. And first they look at him and they're just in awe by how tall he is and how big he is. But then all of a sudden they see someone who looks like them, just a little larger version of them, but he talks like them.
Right.
And that's really important for kids who stutter, to see someone who sounds like them giving the message, to see someone who sounds like them succeeding. Mm-hmm. So we use athletes and movie stars and things like that all the time. Mm-hmm. I often feel that that's more important for parents, though, or for caregivers, to see that people can make it and still stutter. For kids who stutter, I find the biggest mentors for them are other kids their same age. Mm. Because most people who stutter have never met another person who stutters.
Right.
So just getting them introduced to some other kids, some other kind of peers, is usually a really strong, strong way to kind of bring in some support. We run an intensive stuttering program in the summer, in June, for 1 week, where we bring kids from all over together. And they explore stuttering. At the same time, they meet a ton of people who stutter. Adults who stutter, famous people who stutter, and people who are successful in stuttering. And I think by modeling to them what other people have done to succeed, we're increasing the likelihood that they will succeed as well.
That's great. Yeah, that peer effect is really important for children. And like you said, maybe those role models offer parents some hope that their child can still be successful and stutter. So that's great that you have all of those resources. So when we refer a patient who's stuttering to a speech and language therapist, what can we expect or what can the family expect in terms of resolution of stuttering? How often does this happen or how often is it persisting until adulthood?
We know that the vast majority, up to 80% of children who start to stutter, will recover spontaneously, that regardless of whether they go to therapy or not.
Mm-hmm.
We know persistent stuttering impacts about 3 million individuals in the United States, and it has a large impact. So when we think about this, we don't necessarily talk about what's the best way to fix stuttering or when will stuttering go away. Usually when parents ask us, when will this go away, they're concerned that they did something wrong to cause it.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to know, when can this just stop?
Right.
But we often will talk to them about kind of thinking about management of this, and it might be something more long term, especially if there's a lot of risk factors there where we don't think recovery is going to happen quickly. We kind of get them off the fact of thinking about when is it going to stop. And we focus their efforts on how do we increase the effectiveness of their child's communication skills.
Mm-hmm.
And effective communication is really our goal because stuttering impacts two areas. For some kids, stuttering impacts them that they're not able to communicate. For many people who stutter, they can still communicate effectively and it doesn't stop that communication. But for some, the actual ability to communicate is impaired.
Mm-hmm.
A larger part of stuttering, though, is kind of impacts the desire to communicate.
Right.
And so many of the kids that we work with, they're avoiding, they're not talking, they're hiding because they fear what's going to happen if they stutter out loud.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of really talking about when's it going to get over or when's it going to resolve, we really talk about when are we going to reduce the impact of it. Kind of the same way we would be talking about things like Tourette syndrome or ADHD. The behaviors themselves aren't wrong. It's just a difference. But the impact of those behaviors are what we really need to make sure aren't causing the child to be held back.
That's a great way to reframe our thinking about stuttering. So thank you for that perspective. Now, as we mentioned at the beginning, the etiology of stuttering can be really complex and involve lots of different parts of the brain. When should we consider referral to specialists other than speech and language pathology? And I'm thinking, for example, of specialties like neurology or audiology.
We want to think of stuttering kind of this multifactorial model, right? So we want to kind of be able to help in different areas. So, for example, we know that many individuals who stutter present with communication-based anxiety. I have several psychologists that I can refer kids to when I need to. I would also tell you that you should probably make those relationships before you need them mm-hmm. so that when the need does come, you can do them fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But I refer to psychologists when the issues are larger than just stuttering.
Right.
Okay. I refer to other professionals as needed as well. If it's just stuttering though, I can usually handle most of that myself. Now, I have training in 26 years at CHOP. I have sought out trainings to make me more effective at that. It's important to know that not every speech-language pathologist, though, has experience working with people who stutter. So when you refer to a speech therapist, you want to make sure that that person has experience, knowledge, and comfort working with individuals who stutter. We often tell parents they should kind of look at the first discussion with a speech therapist as an interview to see if that relationship is something that you think can be addressed and kind of work together to kind of make progress. So first thing is, make sure you're referring to someone who really knows stuttering.
Mm.
And then I would say the other professionals, really just have them as an as-needed basis, as an adjunct to therapy. Because I don't think there's any specific profession that we always get involved with kids who stutter. I often say that psychologists, especially those that are trained in CBT, they have the tools to work effectively with people who stutter, but they might not understand the underlying speech and language realm.
Right.
Unfortunately, speech and language pathologists understand speech and language, but they often don't have the tools to effectively deal with stuttering. So I think as a good therapist, you need to reach out to learn some things and pull in some tools from other professions, and at the same time, be ready to refer when the issue is larger than just stuttering.
Mm-hmm. Right. Take into account the whole child and what else is going on. Obviously, if there's other neurologic signs or symptoms, they're seeing a neurologist, or if you have concerns about their hearing, you're sending them to audiology to see if stuttering is related to that.
And we also, now we're starting a new study, or we started it here at CHOP, where we're exploring the genetic underpinnings of stuttering. So we do refer to genetics a lot, but it's more for a research paradigm than for a clinical reason.
Right. Well, you mentioned some of the summer resources that you have. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about what you do for stuttering at CHOP and what the Center for Childhood Communication does at CHOP.
Sure. So our speech language pathologists, we have a team here that is comfortable and skilled in working with kids who stutter. So we offer a wide range of services. We offer individual therapy and diagnostic practices. We host the Woody Starkweather Intensive Stuttering Program for teens who stutter in June. And we run workshops and speakers throughout the year. There's also a very strong stuttering support community throughout the world. And social media now has just brought that into everybody's home. Mm-hmm. So we strongly advise folks to reach out to organizations like Friends, the Organization for Young People Who Stutter, or the National Stuttering Association. And we here at CHOP do different types of events throughout the year where we bring in organizations like that to assist us in helping support families who stutter.
That's great. There's so many wonderful resources. So thank you for telling us all about those today and for helping take care of our patients who stutter at CHOP. I appreciate you teaching us more about this really important topic today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Primary Care Perspectives. You can download and subscribe to future episodes on iTunes or visit chop.edu/PCP podcast for a listing of all episodes. I look forward to our next chat.